Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Dan Dean, not Adam Francisco.
Nope, not today.
I think it would take a long time. Thinking Fellows listeners may recognize your name because I think you've been on four or five episodes throughout the years, and but it's been a hot minute.
It has been a while. I couldn't even tell you when the last actual episode number or whatever it was.
I think we were still in San Juan.
No.
We've done a few here.
Yeah, okay. We've done a few at this house, yeah. But I want to get your title right. So associate professor is what the title is? How does that work?
Because titles are the all-important thing. I am a professor of philosophy.
He's full professor.
Full professor.
Don't be insulting.
Whoa. I don't know. I didn't know what the titles at CUI were.
I've put my time in. I'm a professor of philosophy.
All right. So professor of philosophy, Concordia University, Irvine.
I've hit the ceiling.
Okay. Nice. That's good. Well, or not good. I don't know. It depends on who you are. But you you teach philosophy at Concordia Irvine. You've been there a while. You had already been teaching a couple of years by the time I was there, I think.
Yeah, I believe this was just my 12th year.
Okay, you're looking down the barrel of another sabbatical.
I know. Well, yeah.
Yeah?
Maybe I'll finish what I said I'd do on the first one.
That's funny. That will be 7 years ago next year then, right? No?
Yep.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy.
I know. It is crazy. Time is flying.
Wow.
And I think... what we're going to do on this episode, so we've been doing a why you should series, you know, why you should or shouldn't go to college, why you should, I think the last couple we did were, we did why you should have a theology or why you should know what your theology is, kind of make the case for why everybody has one.
Yep.
And just in that vein, and with you today, I thought we would do why you should study philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I remember when I was at CUI, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is you had a decent hand in making the core reader in philosophy while I was there. Now, the core programs change. I don't know if they still use it or how that works, but when I was there, it was a collection of snippets of primary source material that you would read throughout the semester and so sort of make a case for philosophy to the students.
Right. The core has not changed. Okay. At least the core philosophy has not changed since. Were you there for the red book?
Yeah, red and gray. Was theology gray? I don't remember.
Yeah, okay. Yep. But there was a red book that you remember?
A book, yeah.
Yep, that's still the one we use. We haven't changed philosophy since then. That was the, I guess, second and a half, 2.5 version of the original core that we started in 2010. This is one that I had more of a hand in kind of actually prepping for in terms of what we wanted to study in the class. So it's essentially a survey of kind of ancient philosophy. So we chose kind of a historical track.
Yeah, it and starts older and gets
we
newer,
start
right?
with the kind of pre-Socratic ideas and move and end with Augustine.
Okay.
That's kind of the arc of the course.
So nothing modern.
Nothing modern. Yeah. We have a, since you were there, it probably came on board while you were there, Caleb, but we do have a Core 2 class that's for transfer students, and that one starts with Augustine and ends with Kant.
Okay.
So we still don't get into the 20th century.
You just get closer.
We get closer, and it covers kind of the nice historical survey of ancients to Enlightenment. And then we have an analytic course where we'll jump into the more 20th century guys.
Yeah. And do you teach the analytic course?
I teach the analytic course. Yeah. It's offered. It's funny because it's the course I've probably taught the least since I've been there, only because it's offered every other year in one semester.
Yeah.
And the first couple of years I was there, you know, Dr. Rosenblad was still around at the university. So he was teaching that class.
Yep. I was part of Rod's last analytic philosophy class.
I was his first one.
And I never took it.
That he ever, first one he ever taught. And we had to do an independent study.
Right.
And so we would meet at Hoff's Hut, because that's where your mom worked at the time, and with five or six students maybe, and we'd go through it while old Rod would eat a piping hot bowl of cream of broccoli soup.
Yeah, sounds like Rod.
And a glass of rosé filled all the way to the top, please.
Sounds very Rod-ish.
Yeah.
Followed by a coffee.
Followed by mini coffees.
Yeah. And cigarettes, no doubt.
Yes. Yep.
So I think, I mean, one of the facts about teaching freshmen and transfers philosophy who are at a liberal arts university, but you could, I mean, the majority of those students probably are not in a liberal arts degree, business, science, medicine, pre-med kind of thing.
Yeah.
You have to make the case. I mean, all the time you hear students walk around saying, why am I reading Plato?
Yeah.
Why am I reading Aristotle?
How do you make the case for your class to a student that thinks they're majoring in communications or business? Mm-hmm. Communications might be easier. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to think of a real sort of generic, non sort of classic liberal artsy degree. But well, I'm
and that
coming
might
up
give
short.
You a survey of like the general working population too, where it's like, yeah, I know these things are part of how society has gotten to where it is, but you know, I'm living in the results
of
that.
Why do I
need
today?
Why do I need this?
Yeah. So in the early on in the core, we really struggled with this because we were getting a lot of students that are coming in who were, you know, pre-med
and
or
mad.
Nursing. Yeah. And they were mad because like, I don't see how this works at all. I just want to get to my next stage.
Yeah.
And, oddly enough, I haven't, and maybe it's because I'm just older. I don't hear as much of that fight anymore with the students. So they realize the fight would be this. They're just simply not interested in it because all of education to them, particularly in the general ed, is a stepping stone to the next
goal.
Lily pad.
Goal-oriented.
Lily pad, yeah.
Yeah.
So they're just jumping. They said, you know what? I'm going to sit down and do this because I have to do it.
Yeah.
And which is, you know, I play with that idea with them a bit and just try to get them to see that there's more to philosophy than it being a jump, like a stepping stone to the next stage of your life.
There's perhaps more to education than that.
There's more to education. But I've realized that I'm fighting a very uphill battle that starts in these students' lives from grade school on.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in some sense, I've kind of...
One more reason to hate No Child Left Behind.
Yeah, toned back a bit of the kind of just constant emphasis that you need to take this seriously and just tried to work with them where they're at.
Yeah.
So... To your point, though, Caleb, about like how would you sell this? This is the way we talk about it at the college, like amongst my colleagues at the college. How do I sell the value of this? You know, that is a tough one, and it's funny if you go to any philosophy website, any university. It doesn't matter if it's a liberal arts college, if it's a state school, a big R1, or a liberal arts Christian university. You're gonna get a very practical sell, and that it's funny because philosophy is kind of conceived as the most impractical degree you can get, but everyone...
You're majoring in philosophy? Yeah. Great. What are you going to do with
what
that?
What are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
But every website will tell you this. They say, look, you will score better on standardized tests. You will do it if you're a philosophy major or minor. You'll score better. So even our students who, and this is not necessarily the students at Concordia, but just across the board, medical students score better on the MCAT if they have philosophy in their background than pure science pre-med students.
That's interesting.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
And you go, what? So.
Because so much of it's reasoning.
And that, yeah. And so the practical sell, what I'm getting at though, is we kind of become used car salesmen because we're like, well, look, you should take this because we're helping you think better. And the end for you thinking better is a better score on the exam.
So yeah, not just the end isn't that you're thinking better, which is a great end unto itself.
Right.
It's so, that you're going to do better at the perceived goal, which will get you the house and,
and the money and the, all the other stuff.
But if you're going to make a genuine case for it, right, that's not like, you're not having, from in the Thinking Fellows room, you don't have to sell bachelor's degrees.
Back up. So on day, well, maybe not back up. On day one of class, when you're trying to define for the students what philosophy is, what do you say it is?
Yeah. So the first thing I like to tell them is philosophy is not a biology. It's not a theology. It's not an ology study, right?
Yeah.
Think of the classic thing that any, at least I remember my bio teachers or my theology teachers telling me this. What's ology, study of, what's theos, God, what's bio, life? Philosophy is not that. It's philosophy is a sophia.
Yeah.
That's a weird thing to kind of wrap your head around. It's a wisdom, and then it's a love of wisdom. So how do you educate love?
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So I try to disarm them a little bit to say this is not your kind of fact encyclopedic course where you're just memorizing dates and names and concepts and things like that, that I'm actually trying to use Platonic language, turn your soul to this truth that the world, and again, I don't know how well this works with 18-year-olds. I mean, they stay in my class, so it must work reasonably well.
Of course they have to.
And they have to. Yes. But I'm just trying to, I say, look, philosophy is a discipline that will show you the world is much stranger than you think it is.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's the goal. That's what I, you know, and some of you are just going to love it because you're kind of already in a, like, a, you're
disenfranchised with the world.
Well, and you like puzzles and things like that, you know, and others of you are going to hate it. Like, I've never heard from somebody, I'll ask them to go ask their parents. When you go home for your first break, ask your parents if they had a philosophy class and just mark their reaction to it. They're either going to say, oh, that was the best class I ever took.
Yeah,
it was so much fun.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, yeah, I survived it. It was the worst class I ever took. There's no, like, it was okay. Yeah. It's either love it, hate it. And I think it's partly due to the fact that it is this kind of loving of wisdom that we're trying to inculcate into the student that philosophy is important, not so much because it's going to get you things, but it's just going to make you a better thinker, which is going to have multiple ramifications down the line in your life.
I'll sometimes, we did this a lot in sort of the epistemology multiple shows that we've done. Say, you know, the reason you should know something about this or study this a little bit or even think about this regarding, say, like reasoning, how people come to conclusions, why this makes sense or doesn't make sense, from what perspective, you know, because even when you study philosophy, let's say you study some just basic rationalism and empiricism, you can kind of identify why you might be disagreeing with somebody or why you don't think like they do, that they're maybe coming from a more rationalist perspective and you kind of think of things more empirically.
Or maybe why your disagreement's at an impasse.
Yeah, your disagreement's at an impasse. I'm like, this can help you with life in a really particular way, but you kind of have to let it happen to you before you can sort of apply it and apply is a weird thing for philosophy, but you can kind of live it in a way where it actually helps you make sense.
Yeah. What the way I get at this, again, what you're suggesting and saying about the way you were talking about on the epistemology episode, there's three values that all humans... I'm trying to like not sound redundant, but there's three basic values that all humans employ, and it doesn't matter what socioeconomic strata you come from. It doesn't matter what culture you come from. We all make our judgments where, and this is where the arguments will come in later, based on what we take to be good, true, and beautiful.
Right.
Those are the three fundamental values. And I don't care. You can talk to an anthropologist and they'll say, well, look, the people down in the Amazon, they say they're making judgments. They're ordering their lives according to these values. And when we come to impasse with our friends and our enemies over conversations, if you really start paring down where you're disagreeing, it's going to be over a difference of truth, goodness, or beauty.
Or even how they're discerning what's good.
Right.
Discerning what's true or discerning what's beautiful.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that value that philosophy can bring to the conversation is to say, well, let's slow down.
Right.
And let's actually dive a little bit deeper. Because we're probably not arguing about whatever the surface level thing is. The disagreement is coming because we're disagreeing about what is the good, the true, and the beautiful in this situation, or what we take to be in informing our good,
how
the true, and the beautiful,
these things.
How we know these things.
Yeah.
So 21st century philosophy, like again, if you were to go to these departments at the state schools and a school that doesn't kind of take this core text tradition that we've adopted at Concordia Irvine, you're going to, the good, the true, and the beautiful aren't going to be the way they talk about it, but they will. So good usually gets reduced to ethics.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
True is going to be metaphysics and epistemology.
Right.
And then the beautiful is that weird category that nobody talks about called aesthetics.
Yeah.
Right. And so they've kind of departmentalized or compartmentalized those basic values. And I think it loses a bit for the student, you know, again, trying to get this to be important to 18-year-olds when we play that game, it really just makes philosophy more like an ology subject where it's like, well, you just need to know
which category,
what category these things are in.
Which is how I treat philosophy.
Yeah. And it's a good way to get some of the data points in.
Yeah.
Right. But in terms of trying to like sell to a mechanic or a, you know, a 18-year-old who just wants to be a nurse or whatever, the value of philosophy, I try to go just a little bit deeper into that notion that, look, you're already making judgments philosophically every day of your life.
Sure.
And it would behoove you to, and that's, you know, as a philosopher, we're always telling other people what to think. It would behoove you to kind of maybe take that into account sometimes and actually reflect on why you think this thing is good mm-hmm. or true or beautiful, right?
And then maybe even why you think other people should be convinced of the same or order their lives around the same.
Or I'd even think, so in some of my previous jobs, I've had employers who really are into these personality test thingies, right? And so you get together as a staff and you all take whatever.
Oh, yeah, I know. I love
DISC, Myers-Briggs, whatever. And so I'm always the guy that's going, why are we doing this? And the answer is always the same. It's so that you can know why you work well with somebody or why you don't work well with the person mm-hmm. or where you need to work hard, you know, whatever you need to say to them and how you need to communicate to them more effectively and everything. And I'm always sitting there thinking, yeah, that's funny. That could be about their personality, but could it just also sort of be like they were raised to sort of make decisions based on sort of mm-hmm. just more, like I said, rational perspectives or by looking at particulars and
or the way something makes them
and
feel.
And raising up or the way something makes them feel. And I suppose that's personality, but at the end of the day, there's sort of philosophical, epistemological answers to that too that mm-hmm. I think are probably more helpful in a lot of ways than just sort of trying to subjectively take a subjective test that gives you a subjective answer about your quote-unquote personality type, it can be helpful. But
and certain assumptions about goodness, truth, and beauty were already made in the formulation of those questions to ask you to get at what you're supposed to be, what kind of person you are. So,
and as a theologian, I have a hard time with them because I believe God defined me, not a test.
Well, it's good you bring that
up. I love
it
when you get the answer. You are this.
You are. Really?
I'm whatever God says I am, actually.
The last time I accepted that answer is when God called me his child. But okay, we'll go from there.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because, again, being at a Christian university, this is part of the struggle with philosophy, because oftentimes philosophy will get put into service as a substitute religion or worldview or whatever. And you can be like, I'm an empiricist thinker, I'm a rationalist thinker, I'm a Kantian, I'm a Platonist, I'm an Aristotelian or something like that. And one has to be careful of that, because oftentimes you, especially with 18-year-olds and impressionable minds, you get people who just get sucked into saying, okay, well, this has to be the way the world is.
Right.
Like Plato was right. Like he's just right.
And everybody else is wrong.
And everyone else is wrong, right? And that works against the philosophical mind. I mean, again, if there's any value to philosophy, it's to allowing one to become a better critical thinker and not just kind of jump onto the next train of thought that gets me what I actually
want. It confirms my biases.
And as from a theological perspective, we're struggling with that fact that we really just want to justify ourselves.
Right.
I mean, that's what I want.
Yeah.
And philosophy can become a very powerful tool at self-justification.
It sure can. Learn how to wield it. You can move mountains.
Right.
We've been approaching some of these why you should questions through a vocational lens, right? Like, obviously, there's a benefit to your life, but then also, as your life progresses, hopefully, benefits to those people who are dependent and call on you for various things, spouse, children, coworkers, and the like. And in theology, philosophy tends to be competitive, and in fact, in nature, you know, philosophy is competitive if it becomes your ideology, worldview, theology. But it's also been used by theologians always, right? It's just what the goal of that use is, right? You've talked a lot about communicating ideas or understanding the person you're communicating to, right? So philosophy may help you form better rhetoric when you're actually communicating the gospel rather than replacing it. I find the problem is, like, if we look at something that we've talked critically on the show about before, like Christian Platonism, It's just trying to make it's like you said, Plato's right about everything. I'm also a Christian.
Then I must like press Plato into the Bible.
I got to make Christianity Platonist versus saying, well, Plato had some great insights about the human creature and how our desires and how the world and
make decisions.
Maybe that helps me actually communicate better, but my Christianity doesn't have to be Platonist in order to do that.
So on this track, and again, I don't know where this fits in terms of like why somebody should study philosophy or even to
do what you want.
How this might help you in the future, but in the second set of core, the second transfer core philosophy class, I do the philosophy 200 level. We start at Augustine and move to Kant. And so you've got, right at the outset of that class, Augustine and Aquinas, right? And Augustine is the most famous kind of Christian Platonist, and Aquinas is probably one of the most famous Christian Aristotelians. Mm-hmm. And they really did work their hardest to kind of take with Augustine, take Plato's thought and kind of make it work with a Christian kind of biblical authority. And then also Aquinas on the flip side, taking the scriptures and really trying to make it work with an Aristotelian thought. And what's fascinating, after having taught this course and having to dive a little bit deeper into these thinkers and their primary source than I've ever had before, is there's very certain places where Augustine is drawing a theme of thought and he just has to stop. He just stops. So one of them is the will. I mean, if you know Augustine's Confessions, the will and his ability to do evil is really like the problem that Augustine is trying to solve. Why do I do the things I do not want to do, you know, go to Romans 7. And it's interesting when he's unpacking his kind of Platonic philosophical conceptual version of the will, he gets to a point where he just goes to scripture and literally he veers away from the philosophy and says, you know what, but I've got this religious authority and the will is just broken. And it's interesting because he actually provides a stopping place where he's recognized that this Platonic philosophy is not the end all. It cannot go this way. And for Augustine, where I saw it was with the will, with Aquinas, interestingly enough, it was with the, he's talking about the virtue of sorrow and the virtue of, I'm forgetting what the word he actually uses, but in the ancient world, things like sorrow and sadness and grief are vices. But Aquinas, and this is the only place I've ever seen Aquinas do this, because if you've ever read Aquinas' Summa, and you know, your Dr. Francisco can talk to you more about this because he's a pro at this stuff. The way it's written is...
He's a pro at something?
Well, Aquinas.
Oh, okay.
but you've got the... you know, you always have the question, and then you've got the Aquinas lays out the critiques of the question, then he lays out what he kind of thinks, and then he lays out kind of the response to the critiques, this very scholastic way of thinking. And usually in that him struggling with like what I think, he'll always quote the philosopher and he'll start with Aristotle and then move into kind of scriptural references and things like that. So you get the kind of back and forth between
the new Moses, Jesus.
Right. And then the new Moses. Yeah. But when he gets to this thing on sorrow, it's the only place I've seen it where he has no reference to the ancient world. He gets to his little piece. He's got these critiques of it. And then he gets to his piece and he says, is it Matthew where he quotes the man of sorrows? Jesus is the man of sorrows. Yeah. He goes just to a Bible verse. I've never seen Aquinas just quote a Bible verse. But it's because even in Aquinas, who is this great schematic thinker, even he recognized that there's this breaking point between his theological authority, the scriptures, and the thought of man, philosophy, where the philosophers are going to just tweak this and turn it, and it's not going to be true, good, or beautiful, because scripture trumps what the philosopher says. And you don't, it's weird, because you don't see it too often. But
no.
But even those thinkers who try to onboard the ancient world, they reach a crossroads where it's just, nope,
authority.
The way we would say this is, I'm going to hold my reason captive.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, interesting. So if you were, say, at church or something, or making an argument for giving a talk somewhere, or were asked to give a talk on philosophy to, say, like a lay congregation, which is all congregations, right? What?
Perfect tautology.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's why I don't invite philosophers on the show.
Well, we have, there's congregations here near places like CUI where there's a lot of pastors as members in the congregation.
what's the argument there for just like the everyday sort of person?
To do philosophy and study philosophy.
Or maybe even take time out of their day to sit down with Aristotle or sit down with, you know, the Republic or something like that.
The beginning, like with the old books, like if you look at statistics, you know, the average American finishes like two books a year, right? So if you're going
to
say
high to me,
probably, but let's say that let's say
50 pages in two books a year.
Let's say that's true. They buy a lot more than they read. Yeah. Let's say you listen to Thinking Fellows, you bought some philosophy. Why, if you're only going to get through two, three books a year, should you pick one of these?
Like a book on philosophy,
Or philosopher, even maybe.
So
And I think we should make a distinction between a book on philosophy and reading philosophers. Because I think reading philosophers can get you to the point. Let's just say you do a deep dive in Aristotle, right? But you're not sort of doing a greater survey of philosophy or the idea of philosophy or whatever. There's a good chance you could just end up sort of being an Aristotelian without having a greater.
That's good. I'll stick with the ancient world for now. We can jump to the 20th century later if we want. But my philosopher of choice from the ancient world is just Socrates.
Oh, really?
And I mean Socrates as Socrates qua Socrates. Socrates as Socrates. So as opposed to the facts, what I got stuck in my head as I was saying Socrates is Socrates didn't write anything down. So everything we know about Socrates comes through Plato.
Right.
And there's a large academic conversation and argument about whether or not we can trust any of the Platonic sources to give us an accurate picture of Socrates. And we don't really...
Can we trust the disciples to give us an accurate picture of Jesus?
Well, this is a good segue into more apologetic material. So I'll hold, because I do this in the class where we look at the kind of transmission history of Plato, and then I say, now think about this in terms of Jesus for a second, because I know they've had core theology and they've done some of the historical argument, you're on much firmer footing when you're talking about Jesus than you are when you're talking about Plato and Socrates, right? And I think that's a powerful point when you're just looking at kind of the historical scholarship on this stuff. But Socrates was... Socrates was the OG. He was, you know, he's the S in spa. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Both Plato and Aristotle were trying to fix problems, I think, that they saw with Socrates. Right. Socrates doesn't leave us with a systematic thought. He was just out there questioning.
He's the annoying, annoying. This is why you like him.
Yeah.
You do this too. Yeah. He just asks questions.
Well, I'll take that.
You know, he just asks questions and then kind of goes, You give an answer and he's like,
Let's think about that.
Let's think about that.
I think you have some problems at A, that's B, and C.
That's interesting. And you're like, ah!
Yeah. But he is doing that, and it gets him killed. He's literally in the apology.
Like I said, he's so annoying.
In the apology, he calls himself the gadfly,
which
is a friggin' horsefly. And for those of you who have been around horses and have been bit by a horsefly, you know it's not fun, right? So Socrates is that OG. Plato and Aristotle come around, and they're trying to fix things. They're trying to systematize a little bit more. They've got a little bit more of an agenda.
They don't want to get forced to drink hemlock.
They don't want to get forced to die. Plato literally, looking back, says, look what happens when you leave something like goodness, truth, and beauty in the hands of the good man.
Yeah.
You kill him,
right?
You kill him, so I got to fix this. Enter the Republic. Got to figure out what justice is, right? Aristotle does the same thing. But insofar as they do that, to your point about if you just read Aristotle, you'll probably start becoming an Aristotelian. Those are smart dudes, and they're persuasive. Like when you're listening to the way they're talking, you're like, yeah, this makes sense of a lot of things. It works with Christianity, a la Augustine, a la Plato. Aquinas. But their systematicity, in some sense, destroys, I'll say it this way, the freedom that Socrates gave us to question.
Yeah.
Because when you've got the system, you end up fighting for the system more than you end up fighting for the good, the true, and the beautiful. And I think Socrates is a beautiful example. I think there's some others in history, one being Martin Luther. It's not Martin Luther we should hate. It's Gerhard.
Oh, boy.
No, yeah. I didn't say that.
Now,
you're the man, my guy. Yeah.
But because Luther is just kind of wild, right? I mean, he's got that Socratic spirit where he's like, no, let's just question and play with this.
Well, you could have said the same thing.
I could say it with Melanchthon. I could have said it with anybody. Yeah.
To be fair to the Gerhard disciples out there, you could have said this about Melanchthon.
We can talk about the difference between Chemnitz, Melanchthon and Gerhardt some other time, because there is one. But
no kidding. Is there really? Shame and Christmas.
This is another strategy of the philosopher. Get them talking about their pet projects.
But at the end of the day, you know, it's the systematizing.
That's right.
The issue.
Right. And so we'll fight, you know, and again, I got to be sensitive to my role. But one of the things I struggle with sometimes within the LCMS is, am I fighting for the LCMS? Or am I fighting for truth and Christ? And it's the same thing that Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, and it happens in philosophy. I'm going to fight for Wittgenstein. I'm going to fight for my guy, because that's the way I see the world, versus actually kind of saying, you know what? They're all wrong. They're all wrong.
Right.
They're all wrong. They're not. None of them has the stranglehold on what actually is goodness, truth, and beauty.
Right.
And I think that's where Christianity has something very valuable to offer the philosophical world, and why somebody who's not going to be a philosopher should study philosophy a little bit. It's for the positive points that Caleb was talking about. It can make you a better thinker, a better speaker, more rhetoric, better rhetoric. You can engage the world in a slightly more nuanced way. But there's also, from a parent perspective, as I got my children coming up, there's also a certain way that it can help train you to protect against, Dr. Mallinson used to call it, it protects us from the dark arts. Like there's a way that there's, you can get, philosophy allows you to see when other people are starting to be a little bit more manipulating and what assumptions they're making and not questioning. And when they're telling you, you ought to do this, but there's assumptions being made that you can now say, no, I don't actually, that's not right. We can have a question about why I ought to do that. Let's peel the layer back a little bit. So it helps you become a little bit more sensitive to when other people are imposing the system on you or something like that.
Being a system guy, I always but I'm not a system guy.
You're not.
But when it comes to this type of thing, I am very I very much lean towards, oh, this one works better. And so I'd say it this way. I never think that, say, Plato is wrong, Aristotle is right, just to use those two examples. But I do think we're able to discern sort of which one works better in the here and now, which isn't necessarily goodness, truth, or beauty. It's pragmatism on my part. It's like, oh, this... Kind of if you're dealing with real life sort of situations and not just the ethereal or all this, actually grounding yourself in a sort of Aristotelian sort of quasi-empiricism is more helpful.
Mm-hmm. It might help you get to, you know, with the truth thing, that one hangs in the air for us, right? Because we have the truth in Christ and in the gospel. And when things are, when there's something ambiguous, sometimes for Christians it's not, because there's a word from God on this subject. But sometimes when you're living in the here and now, you know, like whether you should make a decision in your life about your career, about your family, about school, or something like that, of course there's wisdom in the scripture still, but it's not the explicit, right? And your reason and perhaps the love of wisdom that helps inform that reason is useful for making those decisions still, right?
Right. Yeah, I think there's an interesting way. So if you take kind of classical philosophy and philosophy in general, you'll still say it's the love of wisdom. Then you put that alongside what scripture says is the beginning of wisdom, right?
Right.
Beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord.
Yeah.
And so the way I interpret that and understand that when I'm thinking about these things is the fear of the Lord is reminding me that I have to be careful not to put my philosophy, and I can't idolize it. I cannot break the first and second commandments using my philosophy, saying this is the way the world has to be.
Right.
Right. When you do that, you get Job, you get Habakkuk, you get the books where God just smacks down the people and just grinds them into the earth. Right.
Yeah.
So that's that kind of theoretical side to philosophy, that theoretical wisdom. Like, I have a vision. It's a Platonic vision, and this is how it all works, right? But scripture, you read the Psalms, the Proverbs, the other wisdom literature, and you realize, yeah, it's very practical, right? I mean, well, the one I like to use is when the father's talking to his son in Proverbs, and there's a scene, there's a the father's like, you know why you shouldn't go sleep with the prostitute, son? Or no, I'm sorry. You know why you shouldn't seduce your neighbor's wife? And in my head, I'm going, I know the theoretical reason. It's the sixth commandment.
Yeah.
Right?
That's because he's going to kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the Bible comes back and says, yeah, it's a very practical reason. It's, oh, you're going to cause tension between you and your neighbor.
Yeah.
And I'm going, that's not what they taught me in high school. Like, that's not my high school youth group answer. Like, you mean I shouldn't sleep with my neighbor's wife just because we're going to now live in tension with each other? No, it's wrong, right? Yeah. That's the categorical answer.
Yeah, but part of it being wrong is that it creates this tension.
Yeah. So there's always...
And with maybe murderous intent. I don't know.
Right. But there's always this tension between that theoretical and that kind of practical that even takes place in philosophy.
That's with, like, you know, when you think about the Pauline epistles and you get sort of lists of pastoral qualifications or lists of your life. It's like, well, you know, why should somebody who's going to be a pastor not have multiple wives or not cheat on his wife? Because it ultimately, the way that affects your neighbor, that tension actually becomes a tension between that person and Christ or that person in the gospel. They won't hear it anymore.
Right.
Because you've done something so destructive to their life that they're not going to hear the forgiveness of sins from your lips any longer.
And I think this is the genius, and I'll just throw this out there with Augustine. When you read Augustine's Confessions, I forget the chapter or verse, but I can find the chapter and the section for the show notes if you want, but he's got I believe it's the Penguin edition of his Confessions, there's a chapter called Augustine Meets St. Paul, and it's where we kind of end the core class with my freshman, because where the Christian has the truth you were talking about in Christ, basically what Augustine relates to us is the ancient world does not know the term forgiveness.
Right.
That concept does not exist.
Nor does the modern world.
Well, true, right? Yeah. So in the ancient world, you're going to find eye for an eye. You're going to find justice that way, and it's going to be reciprocal. But you don't have, and he goes through this just litany of, like, you don't have the passion. You don't have the suffering. You don't have the forgiveness. You don't have the giving of life for another.
Right.
And what I say to my students is, once you internalize that you're, back to your identity question, the claims you're making earlier, once you identify that your identity is in the as a baptized child of God, where your identity is not this life in its totality, but the fact that you're a forgiven sinner, you now actually have the freedom to go be a Platonist.
Right.
And for Augustine, this was like, oh my God, this problem I've been suffering through, like the fact that I know I should be doing these things because my philosophy is saying this is how you live a good life, but I can't do it. I don't actually want to do it. Now that I realize my identity is actually forgiveness, that's who I am, a forgiven child, I can now actually enjoy reading and understanding and trying to see where Plato fits and where he doesn't fit. And you don't have to try to tie up all the loose ends.
You don't have to always be sort of internally consistent with what you're gravitating towards.
I mean, you could be like, look at him. I like Plato.
You don't have to tie it all together. You're allowed at that point to actually say, I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
And it really, I think that's kind of like the intellectual side of it, is Augustine was finally given the freedom to say, I don't actually know how this all works together.
Right.
And that's actually the only group that he saw that took care of that kind of idea was the Christians.
That's so interesting. In a way, you know, part of studying philosophy, I think for me has been learning that there are things that can't be known, and that you do not know, and that even these very, very brilliant ancient philosophers and even more modern philosophers, you know, they had an end point to what they were even willing to grapple with, because it's unknowable. Now, we would say that it's unknowable in a lot of ways apart from some revelation from a divine, which we think we have. But just sort of in sheer reasoning ability of man, whether you're reasoning deductively, inductively, abductively, whatever, you're only going to get so far here with what you can conceive or what you can perceive to help you reason through a thing. And at some point, if you learn by reading these philosophers, you can kind of learn what the limits likely are.
Yeah.
So that you can sort of recognize them. I think it's helpful even like when you're watching the freaking news, man.
Well,
like, you can literally say at some point, well, I don't think you can actually know that.
Here's right.
I think that's a feeling.
Yeah.
You know.
Here's one of mine, and I think you share this one with me that's like totally, let's say, totally unrelated from politics and theology. Ready? Is I've picked up fishing more in the last 5 years. You've started fishing with me.
I mean, to be clear, I fish when you're present.
Yeah, okay.
Because I'm horrible
at it. Because he only catches when I'm around.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. But and I like trout fishing. And anybody who listens to the show who likes trout fishing,
I also don't understand catch and release at all.
That's what I'm about to talk about.
Yeah, okay.
So in the trout fishing and specifically the fly fishing community, the movement has gone to be exclusively catch and release. And there's a lot of these true, good, and beautiful reasons for it, right? The fish are beautiful, and you want everybody to experience this majestic beauty of being outside. The truth is that you don't want to, this is should be enjoyable, but you don't want to excessively harm the animal, mm-hmm. and the good has to do with that harm as well. There's a good way to do this and a wrong way to do this. And so you'll get this universal...
That's how you do it.
You'll get this universal catch and release. Now, I'm not a universal catch and release fisherman. It's certain...
But he will catch and
release. I will catch and release. But... Here's where this breaks down is I've been standing at the lake. Somebody gut hooks a trout. For those unfamiliar, that means it wasn't caught in the lip. It was caught in their throat.
And with a barbed hook. Matter what you do, you're ripping something
if
out.
And any trout are sensitive. Any trout that's gut hooked, if you remove that hook, its odds of survival are basically zero. Mm-hmm. And you will get people proudly release these fish that are just going to die because the system says I am always catch and release, right? That's an instance for me where it's like, if I gut hook a fish, no matter what size, unless the law prohibits me from keeping that fish, I'm going to keep it and find something to do with it because you can't release that fish. It's going to die. You have to break the that particular system of you should always release a fish. But you see philosophies of fishing that say you can't. Mm-hmm. Every trout's got to be released.
Yep. Be a good little Pharisee. Follow your rules. Don't ever, you know, this is where philosophy gets in trouble because, I mean, to play the counterpoint to what you just said, this is what Dr. Keith hates. after the apology in the Credo, Socrates literally follows the law and goes to his death.
Yeah, that's right.
So after he puts up this big stink in the apology, he goes in the Credo and they're like, hey, we can get you out, Socrates. And he goes, yeah, I can't do it. If I do that, that would be unjust. Yeah. And I'd be a vicious person by leaving, even though the law was... turned against me because my duty is to the law.
Yeah, because the law, it was unjust. Yeah.
Right. So the conversation around why we should catch and release a gut hooked fish or why we shouldn't catch and release a gut hooked fish is where the philosophy would happen. My intuition on this one though is you're going to have people who are just perfect rule followers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Versus people who kind of look at the law as, you know, like the way I view 35 miles per hour on the yellow sign going up your guys's mountain. That's just the suggested speed.
Or the way anybody deals with the 55 mile an hour speed limit on the
freeway. Right. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And that has something more to do, I think, with psychology than it actually does philosophy. But philosophy can be bolstered, and this was, again, I think some of the downfall of, say, something like Plato's Republic. Philosophy can be bolstered to create that system of rules that then people get attached to and say, I can't even conceive of why or how I would break these rules.
Well, I think that's what the good life is. The tie-in, if there is a tie-in, has to do with the fact that in sort of the conservation world, or specifically, I'd say, like the trout fly fishing world, the reason you do this is because it's good.
Yes.
Right? One of the reasons you do it, too, is just because it's right. But there's no real sort of, you know, it's not evidence-based. It probably is evidence-based to some degree. But I think you see this, not to get too modernly political, but you see this in sort of the modern cultural conversations where the old notions of good were wholly tossed out, and then you had sort of this transitional period where no one can tell anybody else what's good or right, and then now you're in this sort of period where a new sort of set of good and right were moved in, But the reasoning for them seems like, how do I know that this is good, mm-hmm. or how do I know this is right? It's almost like a, well, it just is.
It just is.
Or yeah. you should, and don't concern yourself with that particular question. Somebody right. else already
figured that out. And, it, and a lot of times it is sort of an appeal to an expert, so it's some mm-hmm. expertism going on here. But it's some at some level, it's just interesting to me that, and maybe it's sort of the lack of reading philosophy, right, that we've kind of gone from the old set of rules, agree with them or disagree with them. Somebody could have made an argument for why they were right or wrong. Like even you said mm-hmm. on the, you know, thou shalt not commit adultery, right, in Sunday school class, well, because it's wrong. But then you read in Ecclesiastes, I think you said it was?
Proverbs.
Proverbs. I believe, yeah. You read sort of a Bible account that gives a more practical explanation. And if you would have had a good sort of, I'm not saying your confirmation teacher was bad, but a good confirmation teacher even back then, they could have bolstered the
right,
argument
right.
With other sort of very reasonable slash practical reasons why sleeping with another man's wife is a really bad idea. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in this period where, and it was actually not too long ago, because I remember these were pretty prevalent conversations at the university 6-7 years ago with, well, you can't say that, and it's always had to deal with sex, in my opinion, but you just can't say that this is right or wrong, or that that's right or wrong.
Right.
And now you're sort of in the area where there are lots of new things that are very right and very wrong, and the reasoning for them almost seems absent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I suppose that, I mean, this, I don't know if this maybe tangentially relates to what you're talking about. It. The downfall to philosophy is people will look at it and say, all you guys do is talk.
Yeah, no.
All problem. You guys do is talk. And you, at some point, you do have to put a flag in the ground and say, I'm standing here, and mm-hmm. right. this is right, this is wrong. And I think that's where kind of like, you know, Socrates, this is right, follow the law, even though I was unjustly accused and whatnot. And where we see that is when things do come down from on high and says like, okay, well, not to get too political, mandatory vaccines or something like that, right? You're like, well, wait a minute, really? Right? We can't even have the conversation anymore because
that's my point.
Because the flag has been laid down.
That's my point.
And there's no way now to say, okay, and this is why I think philosophers are very nervous to lay the flag down because they realize once the flag gets laid,
it's down
and it's really hard to backpedal and say, okay, now let's have let's open up the conversation again, right? And so the philosophers usually are neglected or they're killed because they're trying to, you know, reopen the conversation.
That Dan always sits with his back to a wall.
Yeah.
When he walks down the street, he's always looking over his shoulder.
Because they want something they can do. And I think this is where, to your point, it would be nice to be able to have kind of the theoretical and the practical kind of work together.
Yeah. Yes.
But oftentimes, once the theoretical was laid down, then the practical will follow from that theory versus, okay, maybe we need to kind of rethink it once the practical consequences have played out a little bit. A great example, I think, right now is the Roe v. Wade stuff is actually this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
A flag was planted, and it was not supposed to go the way it did.
When it shut down, not conversation, because we've been talking about it for 50 years, but it shut down the political, civic conversation about it. In other words,
and I would call that more practical, like that civic conversation is a little bit more on the practical side. And
well, now, politicians were no longer able to have conversations that led to legislation,
right?
Because the flag was planted, and now the fear that everybody's having is
literally just to the. The conversation is going to be reopened.
That's right.
And that's what they're scared about.
Well, and the authority decentralized.
The ability to plant the flag will now be with smaller groups of people.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I that's a tough one for me, as, again, being a little bit more libertarian-minded politically and Socratic philosophically, where I am more of like, let's just have more conversation. And then I need people like Dr. Keith to come and say, no, you're going to put the drywall up this way or something like that, so that we can, you know, so we can move forward a little bit.
Yeah, we need to make some progress.
But then be able to then turn back and say, okay, but now we need to have some lower conversation because now that we've let these practical consequences play out a little bit.
We see a problem.
We see a problem, or we don't see a problem. And
you just fired a nail not through a stud.
That was a pipe.
Yeah.
But that's for me. I mean, that's where, because I have this conversation with Dr. Rod Soper at the college all the time. He's a biologist, and he's always like, you guys just never shut up. Like, you just talk, but we need to get something done. And so then he'll, you know, but then he'll he has come to the point where he's like, but I realize now that we actually have to, after we do, and now we have to
reevaluate
and turn back and kind of have the conversation again.
Yeah.
And so that's where, again, the value to philosophy is, it's to me, it's, I'm just following along with kind of Socrates here. It's not about what truth and goodness and beauty I actually end up at. I do think there's I think authority has to be in there. It's scriptural authority, but there's it works on your character for you to actually have the ability to recognize that you might actually be wrong. And a lot of the hills that I thought I had to die on are not actually hills at all, or hills that I really should be throwing all my weight at and dying on. Like, I can actually slow down now. It's oddly enough, Socrates at least kind of goes back into that fear of the Lord, where he says, you know, the wisdom is knowing that I actually don't know how this is going to play out.
It's almost like Socrates, the old man, was trying to teach all the young man that you don't have to die on every hill.
That's right.
And the people that wanted the young men to die on every hill got real mad about it.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my kind of,
I like that,
inculcation of the kind of philosophical task. The word that, yeah. And that's to bring it all the way back to the beginning.
Makes me want to read some Socrates.
Yeah. To bring it all the way back to the beginning. That's my goal with the 18-year-olds, is to try to get them to realize that the world is much larger and bigger than them.
That's great.
That's a good episode, Dan. This has been really great. It's been good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure.
If you would like to support the Thinking Fellows and 1517, you can go to 1517.org/donate. Our podcast network celebration is coming up next week. Our goal for that is to get 100 new reoccurring donors from the podcast network. Next week, you'll be able to help us out with that by going to 1517.org/celebrate. If you're not ready to financially support the podcast or 1517, but you would like to help in another way, you can go to the Apple Podcasts app or the Spotify app, whichever one is easier for you, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the Apple Podcast one, where you can leave a review of the show. Thanks for listening. We will catch you next time. Bye.